Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from the Herald Scotland of Wednesday, the 27th of March, 2024, from the business section. Shares surge 9% in iron brew maker as city backs strategy. This article is by Scott Wright. Shares in iron brew maker AG Barr leapt by nearly 10% after profits beat expectations and analysts underlined scope for the Scottish company to drive further growth and margins. Cumbernauld-based Barr reported a 15.5% rise in profits to £51.3 million as revenue surged by 25.9% to £400 million in the year ended January 28th. Adding that the positive brand momentum had carried into the new financial year. The company declared that its margin rebuild plan was well underway amid signs that the rate of cost inflation in areas such as commodities and labour was beginning to ease towards the end of last year, adding that it remained confident in our strategy and the continued delivery of revenue and profit growth in the year ahead. Research analysts Darren Shipley and Clive Black at housebroker Shaw Capital declared there was much to like about Barr's results as they upgraded their profit forecast for the company for the next 2 years. The analysts said the results make for very pleasant reading, with a modest beat to recently raised guidance confirming an excellent strategic and financial performance. They stated in a note for investors, with a higher base and earlier than anticipated in-house manufacture of Boost Rio volumes, we put through a 10% upgrade to financial year 25 and financial year 26 forecasts, driven by the acceleration in the delivery of the margin rebuild targets set out 12 months ago, 14 to 15%. Anuav Malhotra at Liberum said, "The market underappreciates both the sales growth and margin recovery potential of the business." Later 2024 will see material margin increases versus earlier 2024. There is potential for additional share buybacks, special dividends and further acquisitions due to the strong net cash position of around £54 million. The results were the last annual update to the city, delivered by long-serving Chief Executive Roger White, who is stepping down after more than 20 years at the helm of at the end of April. He is being replaced by Ewan Sutherland, a former boss of Superdry and the Co-op, who joins on May the 1st. Asked to comment on cost inflation, Mr. White told the Herald, "Whilst it is not plain sailing by any matter of means from a cost point of view, some of the big volatility has come out of the market now. In some of the commodity groups and in some of the utility areas, there is much less general bad news. However, there is still underlying and real inflation in wages and in costs coming through as that wage inflation filters its way. Obviously, the most recent inflation figures would appear to suggest that things are a little bit more under control and that hopefully things are moving in the right direction. But we have seen last year high single-digit percentage cost price increases for our customers, and this year it is probably more like low single-digit. That is much more normalised, I would say. On consumer demand for AG Bar products, which, as well as Iron Brew, include fruit-based soft drink Rubicon, cocktail puree brand Funkin, and Boost energy drink, Mr. White said, "I think it has been by and large fairly consistent. It is driven by long-standing trends. Value for money remains important for people, but so does taste. People are buying brands they believe in and that deliver for them, but they have got to be valued correctly. There is pretty consistent consumer behavior across the different channels. The one area that remains a little bit more challenged is the on-trade, where particularly late-night venues have had a tough time in the past 12 months. We continue to see that being a feature." The results were posted shortly after the company announced a review of its bar soft drink sales and distribution operations, which supply the independent retail sector, and an update to the integration of Boost Energy Drinks division, which Bar acquired in a deal worth up to £32 million in December 2022. The two developments could lead to nearly 200 redundancies in total, with 160 potentially affected at Bar Soft Drinks and 35 at Boost, amid plans to close the energy drink small office in Leeds. Around two-thirds of the sales distribution jobs at risk are in Scotland, with the rest in England, though the firm hopes to find suitable employment for people affected in different roles, with retraining offered in certain circumstances. Bar currently employs about 1,000 people in total. The company is now engaged in a consultation process over the cuts. Mr. White said, "We announced this on the 14th of March, so we are literally just starting the process now. That will go on through April and into May." Meanwhile, Bar announced separately that long-standing commercial director Jonathan Kemp will not be seeking re-election at the company's annual meeting on May the 31st, owing to family health reasons. Bar said Mr. Kemp will continue to lead the commercial function until September the 30th, 2024, and then remain available to the company as required for a further 12-month period, following which he will retire from the business. Mr. White said of Mr. Kemp, "Jonathan has had a huge impact on the business over the 20 years that he has been there. Whether it is his commercial acumen or his larger-than-life personality, he is the epitome of all that is good about the brands and the business." The board recommended a final dividend of 12.4 pence per share, giving a total dividend for the full year of 15.05 pence. This represents an increase of 14.9% on the prior year. Shares in AG Bar closed up at 48 pence, or 9.34%, at 562 pence. That article was by Scott Wright. This is from the Herald Scotland of Wednesday, the 27th of March, 2024, from the Voices section. The day Brad Pitt marvelled at the Glasgow School of Art. This article is by Lorraine Wilson. As I looked over at the two figures standing 10 feet away, I thought, I'd recognise that jawline anywhere. Brad Pitt and friend were listening to me talk whilst gazing at the interior roof of the Mac, Charles Rennie Mackintosh's masterwork building at the Glasgow School of Art. In 1993, I was giving a tour of the building to about 16 tourists. It's some 31 years since I joined the roster of guides while in my third year of a History of Art degree at nearby University of Glasgow. Along with others also keen to start sketching out what professional development might be on a CV, I made it over to the art school a couple of times a week to host a tour for the princely £5 wage, enough to buy lunch after or a ticket for an afternoon film at the GFT down the hill. It didn't rub so much at the time that each person on the tour paid about the same per ticket, and there could be more than 20 on the tour. I don't regret it for a second, in hindsight especially, but even at the time I knew we had access to something special, an artistic work of genius hidden in the plain sight of being a working art school building. A perfect example of the tension between conservation and education. Use it and potentially pay the price or lose it. I made this point often. Macintosh designed the building for use. It belonged to every art student to whom these tours were probably an annoyance, if they noticed them at all, although it could be said that artistic practice in the late 19th century didn't present quite the hazard it did 100 years later, but that's a whole other issue. Here, Macintosh was an artist designing for artists. If he needed to ensure that vision was secure, for example, laying bricks and mortar with his own hands, he did that. It was in every corridor seating nook for conversation, in painting studios deluged in light from multi-story high windows, or in sweeping drawbridge-like stone steps, perfect for graduation photos or morning cigarette chats. Everyone else here was a tourist, whether we had paid for a ticket or not. We started the tours in the small reception area, just outside the gift shop, stuffed with its Macintosh giftware. From that small, plain, whitewashed vestibule, there was no way to imagine what came next. Throughout the building, Macintosh literally moved you from dark to light, a journey through time. The art school was built over 10 years in two halves, in stone and brick, and paint and wood. A dark staircase, reminiscent of Glasgow's tenement stairwells, took you up into the museum. Huge black wood beams arched high like the hull of an upturned ship, the black wood noting his interest in Japanese art, while small floral motifs illustrating a lifelong obsession with natural forms. Plaster casts of classical sculptures had made this a light-drenched drawing studio. Off to the east side, a corridor and staircase where light levels dropped as you climbed, a play on Scottish baronial architecture, literally turning this castle on its head. Macintosh didn't just revisit architectural tradition, he moved things forward with wit and confidence. A good contrast is the University of Glasgow's Gothic Revival main building, completed only 6 years before Macintosh started his building, but looking like it's from the 15th century. At the top of the building, we would emerge from another dark passage into the crystal clear glazed panes of what was called the Hen Run. Linking the east and west parts of the building, it was apparently so called because female students, or hens, would use it to join their male friends in the west half of the building. The view it afforded south was wide and expansive, and made the most of the building's placement high over the city, like a challenge to the status quo. After the Hen Run, another dark stairwell led to a room which housed key pieces of furniture, including the iconic tea room chair and table sets, and fine art prints showing Macintosh's move into primary colours and abstraction. I remember one conversation with a visitor here who pointed to one of the iconic ladder chairs and said he'd been able to buy one in 1972 for very little. We ended the tour in the library, presented as the pinnacle of Macintosh's achievement in the building. Smallish, not in the least grandiose, a first-level balcony housing special collections, supported by dark wooden posts, a ground floor clearing in the centre. Windows of glazed continuous columns of light running from the ground to the full height of the balcony level. Jewel-coloured carvings dropping down from the balcony around the room. Each was different, but could be read continuously, perhaps referencing musical notation. So many details, but nothing extraneous. A total work of art, all balance and proportion, warmth and intimacy, subtle yet confidently Macintosh at his best. A public space with domestic ease. I hope you saw it for yourself. Brad Pitt didn't actually come on the whole tour, no doubt bound by a tight Hollywood schedule. He was filming the movie Interview with a Vampire. in the UK at the time. But maybe what he heard and saw in the museum that day was brought to mind when he donated funds to support the first rebuild project, a horrible future scenario we didn't yet have to imagine. That article was by Lorraine Wilson. This is from the Herald Scotland of Wednesday, the 27th of March, 2024, from the Voices section. Tour of Glasgow School of Art Mac building surprised us. This article is by Caroline Wilson. I was one of the first journalists allowed beyond the scaffolding and white wrapping that protects the charred remains of Glasgow School of Art's world-famous Mac building. What was I expecting to see? The answer is not much, with the knowledge that the second fire that ravaged the world-famous building on June the 15th, 2018, was far worse than the first, 4 years earlier. Complex engineering works had to be carried out to stabilise and make the remaining structure safe before investigators could access the site for physical examinations. The fire was so fierce and all-consuming that the cause will never be known conclusively, and most of the treasures within were destroyed. I spent many Saturday nights as a student in the 1990s queuing to dance the night away on the black and white checkered floor of the student union. We weren't GSA students, so this involved persuading one of its own to sign us in, and long waits on dark and drizzly nights dressed to the nines in our latest finds from Virginia galleries. However, it is to my regret that I only visited the Mac building across the road once, despite calling Glasgow my home, and the fact that my sister Lorraine was at one time a tour guide, who was surprised one day to find Brad Pitt listening in. It's not that unusual to ignore the treasures on our doorstep. What I recall from that one visit is taking in the Macintosh Library and imagining sharply dressed students of old burning the midnight oil under the cluster of electric lights that cascaded from the centre of the ceiling. I remember walking across the Hen Run, whose name is believed to be related to the female students who used studios in the Macintosh building top floor. Returning to the Mac 20 or so years later in January last year, this time in a hard hat and boots, the reaction from our group of journalists was shared surprise that more of the structure remained than we might have thought possible. There are now only rectangles where the architect's trademark windows peppered the exterior walls, and fragments of the famous steps leading up to the school. But it did feel as if the essence of the building was still very much alive. The front door, where students including Alistair Gray and Robbie Coltrane passed, is still visible, as well as the wrought iron railings and distinctive Art Nouveau finial. Eleanor McGuinness, who is helping oversee the project to restore the world-renowned building by 2030, said most people given access to the building were taken aback that so much of the original brickwork and structure has endured. She said work by hand to remove 5,000 tons of fire-ravaged building involved 12-hour shifts and was painstaking and robustly done. What we didn't know at that time, when we were invited to see the wreckage of the building, is that more of the structure would be demolished weeks later. No mention was made of that. The west wall and the pillars holding up the iconic library, which was rebuilt after the first fire, had to be taken down. That visit perhaps gave us the false impression that more of the structure had been saved than is the reality. Nonetheless, I think the minds of those who say that the Mac shouldn't be rebuilt again might be changed if they had gone on that tour. It is possible to imagine that Macintosh's most famous building will rise once more from the ashes, hopefully for the last time. It's the little glimpses you get of the building you knew and love, said Miss McGuinness. The concrete stair with the little cutouts, the ironwork, the entrance porch with the guardians over the door, all these glimpses of McIntosh, combined with the drawings we have, show we can bring the building back. That article was by Caroline Wilson. This is from the Herald Scotland of Wednesday, the 27th of March, 2024, from the Voices section. UK electricity and gas prices cap verdict is truly bizarre. This article is by Ian McConnell. You would imagine many people might disagree completely with energy regulator Ofgem's assertion this week that the price cap for household electricity and gas has worked well to protect customers. The claim was made by Ofgem as it declared it was opening up the conversation around the future of price protection as the energy market continues to evolve. Household electricity and gas bills have surged to excruciatingly high levels in recent years. It would be easy to form the opinion that this lamentable development has proved beyond doubt that the energy price cap is unfit for purpose. And it is difficult indeed to see how the prices that households have been forced to pay for energy in recent years could possibly have indicated the cap has worked well to protect customers, as Ofgem would have it. Ofgem this week stated its detailed view on this as follows. The price cap, along with the temporary ban on acquisition-only tariffs, have worked well to protect customers from the loyalty penalty, where customers on default tariffs paid higher prices, and from the worst of the recent volatile markets and wholesale price surges that were a result of the energy crisis. Yes, prices are due to come down from Monday next week, but they will still be very high by historical standards. Of course, there are forces other than the price cap at play here. The Conservative government has failed spectacularly when it has come to security of energy supply for the UK. This has left the country very much at the mercy of global market forces, such as the surge in energy prices with the ending of coronavirus-related lockdowns and from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Of course, the ruling Conservatives could, through immediate bold action, have done far more to mitigate the effect of market forces on consumers. French President Emmanuel Macron took swift and decisive action to limit increases in energy prices for households in his country to far more manageable levels than the frightening increases in the UK. The Conservatives did provide some support when the UK price cap went from the excruciating to the ridiculous, but this was lamentably inadequate. It was announced last month that between April the 1st and June the 30th, the energy price cap would be £1,690 per year for a typical household using electricity and gas and paying by direct debit. Ofgem has noted this is £238 lower than the cap of £1,928 prevailing between January the 1st and March the 31st this year. Before anyone breaks out the champagne, the gap prevailing from April needs to be put into context. Energy prices remain much, much higher than they were as recently as the spring of 2022. In August 2022, Ofgem announced the energy price cap would increase to £3,549 per year for dual fuel for an average household from October the 1st to December the 31st that year. Assistance from the UK government by way of its energy price guarantee meant the cost of electricity and gas for a typical dual fuel household was actually £2,500 per annum during this period. The same applied when the price cap was at £4,279 between January and March last year, and at £3,280 between April and June 2023. These are surely truly ridiculous levels. A research briefing published earlier this month by the House of Commons Library notes, the energy price guarantee was lower than the levels the price cap would have been in Q4 2022, Q1 2023 and Q2 2023. However, it still meant average prices increases of 27% in October 2022. This 27% surge highlights the utter inadequacy of UK government support. The £1,971 per year energy price cap for a typical household that applied from April the 1st to October the 31st, 2022, was a 54% increase on the £1,277 figure for the prior 6 months. The research briefing notes, the monthly increases in both gas and electricity prices in April 2022 alone were by far the largest ever recorded on a series going back to 1988. The annual increases to October 2022 were also the largest ever recorded on a series going back to 1970. These are striking points. In May 2023, Ofgem announced the price cap for the third quarter of 2023 would fall to £2,074 for typical annual consumption at the time. Noting moves since, the House of Commons Library research briefing observes, the price cap fell again in October 2023 by 7%, increased by 5% in January 2024, and is set to fall by 12% in April 2024. Despite those falls in prices, average bills for typical annual consumption under the quarterly cap from April 2024 will be around £600 above their summer 2021 levels. This throws into stark relief just how grim the prices that households have had to pay for energy in recent years have been. The £1,277 cap in place from the 6 months from October the 1st, 2021, calculated on typical use at that stage, might seem attractive relative to where we are now, but we should remember it was a record high at the time. Between April and October 2021, the energy price cap was £1,138. And in the 6 months before that, it was £1,042, again based on typical use at that time. Simply looking at the £1,690 figure for the energy price cap that will apply for a typical dual-fuel household from April the 1st relative to these figures, it is difficult indeed to see how it could be deduced that the regulatory mechanism has worked well to protect customers. Ofgem has set out, as part of its discussion paper launched this week, a range of options on the future of the price cap. It says these include introducing a more dynamic cap with time-of-use dependent unit rates to encourage consumer flexibility. Ofgem also raises the possibility of introducing a targeted cap, which could be based on a variety of factors such as vulnerability. Other options flagged are introducing more flexible market-based price protections, such as setting a limit between a supplier's default tariff and tariffs available in the market, capping the margin suppliers are able to make, or replacing the cap with a ban on acquisition-only tariffs. This is obviously a very wide range of options. And it was put by Ofgem in the context of sweeping changes in patterns of energy consumption and generation. The regulator said, energy retail markets are changing as increasing numbers of consumers change their energy consumption and begin using electric vehicles, heat pumps, and solar panels. Our increasingly renewables-dominated electricity sector will also reward consumers for shifting the time of their electricity consumption, which will in turn reduce costs for everyone. This context will probably be far more interesting to the regulator and others whose day-to-day work is in the energy sector than to households buckling under the weight of electricity and gas costs. However, the decisions made on the actual price cap will have major implications for millions of households. What should inform the option or combination of options that are chosen when the discussion over the future of the price cap concludes is the sure realization that consumers need far greater protection from the vagaries of the energy market than the current arrangements have provided. Capping the profit margin which suppliers are able to make stands out as likely to be among the more effective options, but even that might well not be enough in itself. That article was by Ian McConnell.
This article is from the Herald on Thursday, the 28th of March, 2024. It is from the Voices section, and the headline is Assisted Dying, Let's Have a Respectful Debate on MacArthur's Bill. And the report is by Neil Mackay. You can feel the winds of culture war already blowing around Holyrood's Assisted Dying Bill, and it was only lodged in Parliament yesterday and published today. As a supporter of the legislation, I've promised myself that I won't get dragged into any point-scoring, slanging matches. To do so would disgrace the bill's intention. It's meant to cement one of the last great human rights reforms. It mustn't be debased by Twitter-level rage and distortion. Part of that promise to myself means respecting those who oppose the bill for genuine reasons of personal morality. I hope the many good people on the opposite side of the aisle to me feel and act the same. The concept of death isn't something I want to file with political one-upmanship. Evidently, those who spread lies and disinformation on either side shouldn't be accorded the same respect and should clearly be called out. So I'll try to stick to the facts and leave rhetoric for others. The draft law is a private member's bill from Lib Dem MSP Liam MacArthur. I spent an afternoon with him recently going into the minutiae of the bill. He's a staid, sober, old-school politician. There's no loudmouth bragging. In fact, he's rather humble and very cautious. He's garnered strong cross-party support. The bill is heavily safeguarded. Only those diagnosed as terminally ill can apply for the right to die. There's a mental capacity safeguard where two doctors must agree that the patient fully understands both their condition and the consequences of their choice. This law isn't for people who are mentally ill, depressed, or disabled. It's only for those with a diagnosis of terminal illness and deemed mentally fit. That's its foundation. But there are more checks and balances. Anyone who wants to apply to use the law must be resident in Scotland for 12 months. So Scotland cannot become a suicide destination like Switzerland. There's a two-week cooling-off period. Medication must be self-administered. Conscientious objector rights exist for medics who wish to opt out. Doctors are forbidden from suggesting patients access the law. Requests can only come from the patient. If the bill passes, the legislation will be reviewed every 5 years to ensure it's fit for purpose. Otherwise, it ceases to be law. Mr. MacArthur's bill follows that what's known as the terminal illness model. This is effectively the same system in some US states, Australia and New Zealand. The alternative is the permissive model. This is followed in Canada, Holland, Belgium and Luxembourg. Under the permissive model, a diagnosis of terminal illness isn't required to access the law. Broadly, the permissive model can be used due to intolerable suffering. I agree with Mr. MacArthur when he says the permissive model and its concept of intolerable suffering is highly problematic. It's far too subjective. In Canada, it was courts which led on the right to die, not politicians as in Scotland. Canadian courts agreed with plaintiffs who felt their constitutional rights weren't being respected when it came to the right to die. Parliament then reluctantly legislated. This made bad law. Moves to expand the Canadian law to allow access for people with mental illness have been paused. One of the most common and misplaced concerns is that Mr. MacArthur's bill will create a slippery slope where Scotland morphs into Canada. However, terminal illness models don't metamorphose into permissive models. We've seen this proven worldwide. In Oregon, right to die laws have existed since 1997 and eligibility criteria hasn't changed in 27 years. Scotland's Humanist Society, which has campaigned for the bill, describes the Canada trope as the most consistent bad faith argument used against assisted dying. The Society's chief executive, Fraser Sutherland, told me that it was fundamentally inaccurate. There is ample evidence of jurisdiction round the world where assisted dying laws for the terminally ill have been introduced and have not been extended at all. The slippery slope is a mirage. Mr. MacArthur has rightly called for both Holyrood and the nation to focus on the bill he has drafted, not deeply flawed legislation from Canada. There's a desperate need, he told me, on the part of some opponents to spend all our time discussing Canadian legislation. There are understandable fears around the elderly being coerced by unscrupulous relatives into an early death. However, this fear is misplaced. In Scotland, only those who are already dying can access the law. Put crudely, why bully your granny into suicide when she's dying anyway? In fact, research around the world shows that relatives mostly try to prevent their loved ones accessing such laws rather than urging them to take their lives. Support among the public now stands at around 75%. Politicians are finally catching up, and it seems Mr. MacArthur's bill will eventually pass into law, unlike earlier attempts at Holyrood which failed, most notably legislation by the late Margot MacDonald, who sadly died from Parkinson's. Both Mr. MacArthur and the Humanist Society say that religious groups now form the main opposition. The healthcare profession, most notably in the shape of the British Medical Association, has moved from a position of opposition to one of neutrality. Those of a religious persuasion are, of course, entitled to their views. It should be hoped that they exercise their right to express those opinions in an honest way. The Humanist Society fears faith groups will distort and muddle the debate. There is a horrible truth at the heart of this all. We already have a form of assisted dying, except it's not legislated for, and so therefore not controlled. There are, as Mr. MacArthur told me recently, instances where medics, possibly in discussion with family, sometimes not, are increasing morphine to manage pain in the certain knowledge that it's significantly increasing the risk of hastening death. So we've basically got assisted dying. We're just not either honest about it, transparent, or robust in the way we regulate it. That's a hard discussion for anyone. All of this is hard to discuss. But Scotland is going to have this discussion now the bill has landed in Parliament, And for all our sakes, we need to debate with respect, honesty, and decency. If we can't discuss death in a dignified manner, then what sort of society are we? That report was by Neil Mackay. This article is from the Herald on Thursday, the 28th of March, 2024. It is in the Voices section and the headline is Ferguson's was a shambles, yet they shoot the messenger. The report is by Brian Wilson. One good thing about the removal of David Tideman as chief executive of the Ferguson shipyard at Port Glasgow is that it sets a precedent. Finally, it is possible for someone to carry the can. That novelty must surely be built on. Over a decade, this saga has assembled a cast of villains, none of whom has paid any penalty. Mutual interest has underpinned the invulnerability of politicians, civil servants and sundry associates. There is general surprise that Mr. Tideman is the precedent setter. Since he accepted the poison chalice in December 2021, he came across as an adult in the room who identified the scale of problems and got on with addressing them. Whoever's fault it is that the order for two modest Calmac ferries is running 7 years late and costing at least quadruple the original fixed price, it is not David Tideman's, whose main offence, it seems, has been an excess of frankness. He kept coming back to ministers and Holyrood committees to tell them the ferries would be delayed even longer and cost even more. Recipients of these messages did not react well. Neither did the random bunch scraped together as the board of Ferguson Marine, Port Glasgow Limited, not the most attractive gig for itinerant non-execs. Mr. Tideman's fate appears like a classic case of shooting the messenger. It wasn't his fault more time and money were required to finish the ferries. These inevitabilities were baked into past failures under his predecessors, both private and public. I visited the Ferguson Yard a couple of months ago, and Mr. Tideman gave a tour of the Glen Sannochs. I am relatively well versed in this whole affair, but still found what I witnessed astonishing. Round every corner was a story of almost unbelievable incompetence which had to be fixed. For example, it had become apparent that when the bow of the vessel was lowered, it did not fit securely. A specialist team was required to correct this rather basic flaw. I don't know whether it derived from design specifications, errors in construction, or deterioration over the years of waiting, but it was an inescapable fact that the work had to be done. Repeat that by hundreds, including the nonsensical environmental wheeze of dual fueling the vessels with diesel and gas imported from Qatar to be trucked from Kent to Ardrossan and Skye. So long past that spares required to fix the original installations were unobtainable. Mr. Tideman's fault? None of this came cheap, and cumulatively kept ratcheting up the millions. Mr. Tideman became the bearer of bad news because there was so much bad news to report, but it was also clear that he had respect from the workforce who recognised a shipbuilding man when they saw one. This is borne out by his standing in the industry. I doubt if he intended to be at Ferguson's very long once the ferries were in the water. Meantime, he worked hard to rebuild the yard's credibility within the industry. This involved telling the Scottish Government how much they would have to invest in order to secure future orders. Again, they did not like what they heard. What happened at Holyrood on Tuesday was extraordinary. The SNP MSP for Inverclyde, Stuart McMillan, sought to raise an urgent question about Mr. Tideman's dismissal. This required a vote in which four of Mr. McMillan's colleagues sided with the opposition. It needed the SNP's Green confreres to deny his request. At this point, the Cabinet Secretary, Mary McCallan, intervened to say that the decision to terminate the contract was entirely for the company's board. It is difficult to know which would be worse, that this was true, which I do not believe, or that it is untrue. There was no such shyness about ministerial involvement when Mr. Tideman was appointed. The then Finance Secretary, Kate Forbes, hailed it as an important milestone for Ferguson Marine, which reflects the progress made. David Tideman brings four decades of industry experience and senior leadership, and will be key to securing our long-term ambitions for the yard. Note the word, our. This is a publicly owned asset, and vast sums of public money have been sunk into it directly and indirectly by the Scottish Government, which also appointed the chairman, a court favourite named Andrew Miller, who previously chaired Prestwick Airport and has no shipbuilding pedigree. Miss McCallan cannot divorce herself from responsibility by that one degree of separation. The interim replacement of Mr. Tideman by a non-executive board member begs plenty of its own questions. How and over what period was this week's coup hatched? What process did Mr. John Pettigrew go through before being parachuted into the role? He lives in Canada, and his shipbuilding experience was in the Middle East. It is by no means apparent why he is better placed than Mr. Tideman to chart a course for the future of a small shipyard on the Clyde. Perhaps Miss McCallan will in due course explain. The reality is that this decision could not have been taken without ministerial approval, and equally that the minister takes her advice from Transport Scotland, where so many of the Ferguson bodies are buried. The starting point is that the order should never have been gifted to the yard in the first place, in the absence of a builder's refund guarantee. It was political opportunism at its worst in the name of saving the yard, but has actually done it reputational damage that may be beyond repair. Not that anyone in Edinburgh cares, but the islands also continue to pay a huge price for this folly. Other than Mr. Tideman, nobody has resigned or been sacked. The treatment of him is an additional reason why a public inquiry conducted under oath is required to get at the truth. Otherwise, they all walk away scot-free. Meanwhile, there is a vital question to resolve. Who will launch the second ferry? Perhaps Nicola Sturgeon can be pressed into service one last time. That report was by Brian Wilson.
From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 1st of April, from the Arts and Entertainment section, book review. Double Proof by Martin Stewart is a comedic detective novel. This article is written by Alistair Mabbott. Double Proof, Martin Stewart, Polygon, £9.99. Although it opens ominously enough, its protagonist appearing from nowhere, sweating in daze, hands outstretched in front of a police car, there's a lot of fun to be found in Martin Stewart's appealing and comedic detective novel. The Yakuza have taken up residence in Maryhill. Amateur sleuth Robbie Gould is zipping about Glasgow in his beleaguered spearmint Fiat, trying to rescue a kidnapped teenager, while his ex-wife, a detective inspector, berates him for piggybacking her case and, in a weirdly charming moment, 10 kilos of heroin turns up, garnished with the tag, "Please look after this smack." But to backtrack, in 2012, journalist and former middleweight boxer Robbie Gould went to the police, claiming to know the whereabouts of a missing girl, Amy Porter. He was right, although Amy was tragically dead by the time officers reached her. Gould had deduced her location simply by studying all the available evidence and using his reasoning, but that wasn't sensational enough for the papers, who dubbed him Psychic Crime Buster, an albatross that's hung around his neck ever since. "Getting on people's tits," he said, "is his true superpower, and with it comes great responsibility." 11 years on, he's living quietly on the West Coast, writing novels. But with debts mounting and his agent terminating his contract, Gould gives in to the pleas of the wealthy Imelda Dalziel to find her missing 19-year-old son, Albie, reluctantly donning the mantle of psychic investigator once more. It shouldn't be too hard, he thinks, as Albie is just a social media influencer who has staged a fake kidnapping to impress other social media influencers. If only it were that simple. The more he finds out, the more the evidence points towards a singular case of whiskey. Imelda and her brother Bertie are heirs to a distillery dynasty which once produced reputedly the finest whiskey ever to come out of Scotland. Double proof. Only 61 bottles existed and the entire consignment went missing 50 years ago. It's recently turned up again and, should net the DL's £15 million, if it weren't for the fact that a salvage merchant named Ben Mears claims to have documentation proving they no longer own it. Stuart has made the leap from writing for children to adults with stylish ease and a hint of swagger. His curation Robbie Gould is charismatic and irritating in roughly equal amounts, a down-at-heel misfit with enough intelligence, nerve and resourcefulness to actually make it as a private detective, should he ever choose to. In an undecipherable hand, he scrawls on a scrap of paper the names of the dramatist personae, lighting them with arrows which he fervently believes will reveal to him who's behind the plot and where Albie is being held. Once he's been persuaded to take the case, the initially unenthusiastic Gould is commendably serious about seeing it through, even though it forces him to grapple with two things he knows virtually nothing about, whiskey and social media. Stuart wrings a fair bit of amusement from Gould's unfamiliarity with the world of TikTok, Instagram and their influence obsession with likes and followers which, like the rarefied world of the distilling elite, bring him out in snappy, defensive clips. He seems a lot more at home squaring up to his boxer's physique, to bent coppers and underworld goons built like walk-in fridges, even if he usually takes a lot more punishment than he dishes out. More than just a capable debut into the adult market, Double Proof is a solid, confidently told tale laced with sardonic wit and driven by cat-and-mouse energy. And that book review was of Double Proof by Martin Stewart, Polygon, £9.99, and the review was written by Alistair Mabbott. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 1st of April. From the Arts and Entertainment section, J.K. Rowling mocks Scotland's new hate crime legislation. This article is by Andrew Learmonth. J.K. Rowling has challenged Police Scotland to arrest her after she publicly misgendered a number of trans women. The Harry Potter author ridiculed Scotland's new hate crime law, saying it was wide open to abuse by activists who wish to silence gender-critical feminists, those who believe sex is immutable. The Hate Crime and Public Order, Scotland Act 2021, consolidates some existing laws and creates a new offence of stirring up hatred against protected characteristics, including age, disability, religion, sexual orientation and transgender identity. It does not include sex. A separate misogyny law was promised by Hamza Yousaf in his first programme for the government, though it is yet to be published. The First Minister has previously insisted that the protections for freedom of expression in the legislation means it will not be a criminal offence to say that a trans woman is a man. However, speaking today, his Minister for Victims and Community Safety told the BBC that it would be up to Police Scotland to judge whether or not it was a crime. Siobhan Brown said the police would need to investigate. In a series of posts on X, the site formerly known as Twitter, Ms. Rowling shared pictures of trans women, including Isla Bryson, a double rapist previously known as Adam Graham, who only began identifying as a woman after being charged. The Edinburgh-based writer tweeted, "Lovely Scottish lass and convicted double rapist Isla Bryson found her true authentic female self shortly before she was due to be sentenced. Misgendering is hate, so respect Isla's pronouns, please." She also shared images of Amy George, also known as Andrew Miller, a Borders butcher who abducted an 11-year-old girl while dressed in female clothing and then sexually assaulted her and kept her captive for over 27 hours. "No idea why this was mentioned in court. Of course she was wearing women's clothing. She's a woman," Ms. Rowling tweeted. In another post, she mocked Mirida Wada, the trans woman in charge of Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre, who caused controversy in 2021 by suggesting bigoted rape survivors should be re-educated about transgender rights as part of recovering from their trauma. Ms. Rowling tweeted, "She has no gender recognition certificate, but was still appointed to a job advertised for women only. Time to be challenged on your prejudices, rape victims." The writer then added, "Only kidding. Obviously the people mentioned in the above tweets aren't women at all, but men, every last one of them." She then accused the MSPs of placing higher values on the feelings of men performing their ideas of femaleness, however misogynistically or opportunistically, than on the rights and freedoms of actual women and girls. Ms. Rowling said the new hate crime legislation was wide open to abuse by activists who wish to silence those of us speaking out about dangers of eliminating women's and girls' single-sex spaces. The nonsense made of crime data if violent and sexual assaults committed by men are recorded as female crimes. The grotesque unfairness of allowing males to compete in female sports. The injustice of women's jobs, honours and opportunities been taken by trans-identified men. And the reality and immutability of biological sex. She added, "I'm currently out of the country, but if what I've written here qualifies as an offence under the terms of the new Act, I look forward to being arrested when I return to the birthplace of the Scottish Enlightenment." Her comments came after the Scottish Government Scotland's Minister for Victims and Community Safety, Siobhan Brown, told Radio 4's Today programme that misgendering someone could be a crime under the new legislation. She said, "It would be a police matter for them to assess what happens. It could be reported and it could be investigated. Whether or not the police would think it was criminal is up to Police Scotland." The MSP added, "There is a very high threshold which is in the Act which would stop up to Police Scotland, and what would have been said online or in person would be threatening and abusive." Ms. Rowling was reported to Northumbria Police last month for misgendering transgender broadcaster Indale Willoughby. Speaking to media earlier, Mr. Youssef said he was very proud of the new laws and very confident in Police Scotland's ability in order to implement this legislation in the way it should. A Police Scotland spokesperson said, "We have not received any complaints." Meanwhile, speaking to journalists in Drumchapel, Scottish Labour leader Anna Sauer refused to say if he would repeal the new Act if he were First Minister. He said, "The biggest flaw in the Hate Crime Act is that misogyny is not included. That was an amendment that we had, sadly an amendment that was voted down. It was something that we maintained throughout every stage and in our manifesto as well, that we would include misogyny in the Hate Crime Act. I think the biggest challenge is that what Parliament intended and what Parliament passed is now flawed in terms of its implementation and its messaging. I think the government has messed up the implementation, they've messed up the message, and they haven't adequately resourced our police officers. The point I'm making is that I don't think this is an issue of repeal," he added. "How do you correct the flaws and the missing pieces of the legislation? And how do you correct the implementation, the messaging and the resourcing of the legislation?" Mr. Sarwar said the government was undermining goodwill from the public. And that article was written by Andrew Learmonth. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 1st of April, from the business section. Bruce Inn, opposite Falkland Palace, Fife, brought to market. Article written by Brian Donnelly, business correspondent. A historic pub that looks onto a former palace of Scottish royalty has been brought to the market. Drysdale and Company said that the former coach house, built over 400 years ago, has been offered to let, but added that the owner may sell. The Bruce Inn, which sits opposite Falcon Place in the Fife village of the same name, has a kitchen and a beer garden. The agent said the hotel, which has over the years operated under different names, including the National Hotel, also has three letting rooms and a two-rooms owner's apartment. Canmore describes it as, dated 1607, at inscribed lunette panel, remodelled early 19th century. Three-storey, four-window, square rubble, original moulded paintings on first floor, others 19th century with margins, two artisan pilaster door pieces, background with inset pediments dated 1611, evidently from Mondrief House. The hotels and B&B's site state that the front-facing rooms have excellent views of the 16th century Royal Palace of Falkland, whilst rear-facing rooms look out over the historic village of Falkland to the Lomond Hills. Mary, Queen of Scots, was possibly the palace's most famous resident. And that report was written by Brian Donnelly and read by me, Ian McKenna. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 1st of April, from the news section, Dundee murder probe as a man found dead on Charleston Road. This article is written by Gabriel Mackay. Police in Dundee are probing a suspected murder after a man was found dead. The person was found seriously injured on Charleston Road on Sunday, March 31st, and taken to Nine Mills Hospital. The man later died in hospital, and his death has been treated as suspicious by Police Scotland. Detective Inspector Mark Lamont of Dundee CID said, "Our thoughts are very much with the man's family and friends at this very difficult time. We have a dedicated team of officers working on this investigation, and extensive inquiries are continuing to establish the circumstances of his death. I am appealing to the community to get in touch with us with any information they have. I would urge anyone who saw or heard anything suspicious, no matter how insignificant it may seem, to contact us. I would also be keen to speak to anyone with any CCTV, dashcam or other footage that they think would assist the inquiry. We will have a continued police presence in the area, and anyone with any concerns can approach these officers." And the article was written by Gabriel Mackay. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 1st of April, from the news section, Jimmy Johnson fence row in Cathkin Park could see court move. This article is written by Katrina Stewart. Think of football in Glasgow's south side and the mind immediately turns to Scotland's National Stadium. However, only a few streets over from Hampden Park sits another football facility, this one with less prominence but arguably as much significance to the local community. A pitch in Cathkin Park is the only functioning remains of a 50,000 seat stadium once known as the Second Hampden, where Queen's Park and Third Lanark once called home. Now maintained by Glasgow City Council, the space was taken over in 2022 by the Jimmy Johnson Academy, a charity founded in memory of the late Celtic player. The lease was on the proviso that the football pitch in the Mount Florida area of the city would remain open to the public. To the ire of locals, a fence has now been erected around the pitch in a move criticised by residents as the privatisation of a local park. While the council confirmed planning permission was given to the academy to erect the barrier, one local man is now taking the local authority to court over the legality of the matter. In what is believed to be one of the first cases of its kind in Scotland, park neighbour Greg Brown has taken legal advice on the 3 metre high fence and has begun crowdfunding for a judicial review in the Court of Session. His petition has gathered more than 1,000 signatures and, as well as raising concerns for Scotland's right to roam and local wildlife, reads, "Playing in a public park must remain free to all. I firmly believe that football should be for everyone, but this is the last grass pitch in a public land in the southeast of Glasgow free for anyone to use," Brown wrote in a crowdfunder for his legal costs. "We've been sharing our park with the club for 15 years and will continue to. They don't need a fence. The move is high risk," he said, "because while he is receiving pro bono advice from law firm R&R Urquhart, Mr. Brown would potentially have to pay the council's legal costs if the case fails. Local families have rallied to the cause, holding fundraising events and protests to draw attention to the plight of the park. Recently, more than local residents held an emergency picnic and family fun day to protest against the fence. Organised by locals, the colourful day included crafts and circus skills, food, an all-age football match, and the decoration of the fence with banners showing slogans like 'Kick this fence out of our park' and 'Keep the pitch open to the community.' The emergency picnic at Cathkin Park was a huge success. Groups of concerned residents, young kids, and families came together to say no to the fence. We want to keep this park public and open for everyone to use, play and benefit from. Tammy Payne, local resident and one of the organisers of the picnic, said, "We really hope we can work together as a community to make sure the park is accessible for all." Cathkin Blazes football team was set up in 2021 for women and non-binary people to play the game and socialise following the isolation of the pandemic. Lucy Esco, a local resident and a member of Cathkin Blazes football team, said, "As a member of Cathkin Blazes football team, I think it's really important to have pitches accessible to the community and free of charge. The south side of Glasgow needs more accessible pitches, not less, so that outdoor sports can be truly inclusive and enjoyed by all. I came down with my partner and my child because we wanted to support the Save the Cathkin Park campaign," Matt Barnes, local resident to Cathkin Park, added. "Parks are really important to us. We live in a tenement flat on the second floor and our close garden is small and often not reusable for kids. So we've come to the park to get free accessible space where they can run around and be healthy. We meet all our parents here, they bring their kids, so the kids get to socialise, and it's free. Having these spaces is really important." A spokesperson for the Jimmy Johnson Academy said the fence protects the pitch from vandalism and the rest of the park is still open to the local public with no intention to further restrict access. In the article, written by Katrina Stewart. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 1st of April, from the news section, motorcyclist killed in Rosyth after crash involving BMW. Report by Gabriel Mackay. A motorcyclist was killed in a collision with a BMW, with police appealing for information. The 49-year-old man, who was riding a black Suzuki, was involved in a crash with a white BMW on Queensferry Road at the junction with Aberlour Street in Rosyth on Sunday evening, March 31st. He was pronounced dead at the scene after emergency services attended. Road Policing Sergeant Scott Kirkpatrick said, "Our thoughts are with the family of the man who died at this very difficult time. Our investigation into the crash is ongoing. This is a busy road and we are appealing to anyone who has not already spoken to officers and who has any information that could help with our inquiries to please contact us. I'm also keen to speak to any drivers who have dashcam footage that may assist. Anyone who can help is asked to contact Police Scotland on 101, quoting incident number 2363 of 31st of March 2024. In an article written by Gabriel Mackay. From the Herald, Monday the 1st of April, from the news section, Scotland qualifiers consultation launched by Holyrood. This article is written by Gabriel Mackay. The Scottish Government has announced it will launch a consultation on making the national football team's qualifying matches free to air. The men's and women's matches at major tournaments such as the European Championships or World Cup are protected and therefore must be broadcast on free-to-air television. However, that is not the case for qualifying matches which are sold as a block by UEFA and are often on subscription services such as Viaplay. Broadcasting policy is a reserved matter, with the UK government deciding which tournaments and events are protected. The Scottish Government has said it will enact a consultation to evaluate the balance between the ability of Scottish rights holders, such as the SFA, to generate income to reinvest in Scottish sports and access for Scottish audiences to sporting events. First Minister Humza Yousaf said, "The Scottish Government is taking a further step towards making major Scotland international football matches available free to air, which would allow the whole country to get behind our national teams in important qualifying fixtures. Scots celebrated as our men's national team charged their way onto scintillating form this year's European Championships, and will all be behind the women's national team when their qualifiers get underway next month, but most Scots are blocked from watching the national team with the bulk of games shown on a pay-per-view basis. With so much at stake in qualifiers, our vision is for all fans to be able to watch their national teams as they battle to reach the world's biggest competitions. With the full powers of independence, the Scottish Government would have the power to determine the list of events that should be available to broadcast free to air, to reflect the interests of Scottish audiences, and enable broadcasters who have a public service remit to better meet these needs. But broadcasting policy is currently reserved to the UK Government, and only Westminster can add to these matches, being included in the so-called crown jewels of international sporting fixtures for free-to-air broadcast. With the UK Government refusing to act to resolve the situation for Scotland fans, the Scottish Government will launch a consultation on the issue to help progress the campaign to ensure Scotland international qualifying matches are on terrestrial TV. Further evaluation work will be taken forward to understand the implications such a decision would have for rights holders, including the SFA, before the Scottish Government's case is brought forward to the UK Government. And that article was written by Gabriel Mackay. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 1st of April, news. Scottish Government given warning over education cuts. Report by Gabriel Mackay. Campaigners have called for more funding to be provided to vulnerable children, with funding slashed in recent years. The Scottish Children's Services Coalition said funding for those identified with additional support needs had been cut by 33.9% since 2012-13. In the same time span, there was a doubling in the amount of ASN pupils, who currently represent a third of the school population, as well as the loss of 546 ASN teachers. The SCSC is calling on the Scottish Government to work with local authorities to increase the funding to support the needs of vulnerable children and young people, including greater provision of specialist ASN teachers, educational psychologists, behaviour support staff and classroom assistants. A spokesperson for the SCSC commented, "It is devastating to note cuts in spending supporting those with ASN, and we would urge the Scottish Government to adequately resource the provision of the likes of specialist teachers, educational psychologists and classroom assistants. We are facing a lost generation of children with ASN, and it is vital that they get the care and support they need, when they need it, especially given the impact of the COVID-19 and cost of living crisis. This is also key if we are to genuinely close the educational attainment gap, as we know that those with ASN are disproportionately drawn from poorer neighbourhoods. We are experiencing a mental health emergency and have also witnessed dramatic increases in classroom disruption, impacting on pupils and teachers alike. This is in part due to increased levels of social, emotional and behavioural difficulties post-lockdown. The Scottish Government and local authorities must work together to provide adequate resource support across Scotland for those children and young people with ASN, representing some of the most vulnerable individuals in our society." A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "The Scottish Government is committed to improving the experiences and outcomes for young people with additional support needs, which we have outlined in our programme for Government 2023-24. While it is for local councils to determine the most appropriate educational provision, spending on additional support for learning reached a record high of £830 million in the most recently published figures. The Scottish Government also invests an additional £50 million per year to help schools respond to the individual needs of children and young people. We also provide over £11 million in funding to directly support pupils with complex additional support needs and services to children and families. Ministers will work with teachers to provide additional professional learning opportunities while seeking work to build on the additional support for learning action plan." And that report was by Gabriel Mackay.
The Herald on the 2nd of April, and the news section. Dundee man charged following death of 43-year-old, by Gabriel Mackay. Man is due in court following the death of a man in Dundee. As previously reported by the Herald, a 43-year-old man was found seriously injured on Charleston Road on Sunday, March 31, and taken to Ninewells Hospital where he died. A 43-year-old man has been arrested and charged in connection with the death. He is due to appear at Dundee Sheriff's Court on Tuesday, 2nd April 2024. Detective Inspector Richard Bird said Baird said, "Our thoughts are very much with this man's family and friends at this very difficult time. Extensive inquiries into this incident are ongoing, and we are continuing to appeal to the public to get in touch with us with any information they have. I would urge anyone who saw or heard anything suspicious, no matter how insignificant it may seem, to contact us. I would also be keen to speak to anyone with any CCTV, dash cam, or any other footage that they think would assist the inquiry. We will have a continued police presence in the area, and anyone with any concerns can approach these officers. Anyone with any information is asked to contact 101, quoting incident 4387 of 30 March. Alternatively, information can be passed on to Crime Stoppers anonymously by calling 0800 555 111. And that's by Gabriel Mackay.
This is from the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 2nd of April, 2024, from the business section. Dark Art Distillery in Kirkcudbright eyes Scottish Margarita. This article is by Ian McConnell. A distillery in southwest Scotland has launched a 100% Blue Weber agave spirit, Vespero, and heralded its creation of the Scottish Margarita. Dark Art Distillery, based in Kirkcudbright, said it had launched the new spirit for the start of International Dark Sky Week, which runs from April the 2nd to the 8th. It's noted that Vespero translates to Venus in astrological circles, and it was born and bottled under one of only six dark sky communities in Scotland, the Galloway Forest. Dark Art Distillery said brand founder Andrew Clark Hutchison was born in Mexico, and the emotions linked to his birthplace of born in Mexico, made in Scotland, are central to him launching the Scottish Blue Weber Agave Spirit. Mr. Clark Hutchison said, "On International Dark Sky Week, what better time to launch Vespero, which links closely to the skies above Kirkcudbrightshire, where it is created. As the spirit was not distilled in Mexico, we cannot call it tequila, as Mexico own all the rights of provenance. However, we use only organic 100% Blue Weber agave, yeast and water to make Vespero." He added, "It tastes like you would imagine, with our master distiller, Gerard McCluskey, using his skill and judgment to create a Caledonian homage to tequila with a very smooth finish. It is vibrant, with sweet, grassy and toffee notes, with a cosmically smooth and warming, peppery finish. Gone are the days of shots, salt and lemon. Our brand is premium and can be sipped over ice or as a mixed drink. We have also created the Scottish Margarita, which will be rolled out across bars this month." He declared the tequila and mezcal category is booming in the UK and all over Europe. That article was by Ian McConnell. This is from the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 2nd of April, 2024, from the business section. Kilbarkin Church, Ramage's Bar in Kilburnie, Ayrshire, for sale. This article is by Ian McConnell. A church in Renfrewshire and a bar in Ayrshire are among 30 lots of commercial property and development land across Scotland going under the hammer this month. The church building in the Renfrewshire village of Kilbarkin has full planning approval and a building warrant in place for 17 flats, Shepherd Chartered Surveyors noted. Shepherd, which will hold its latest live-streamed auction on April the 18th at 2:30 p.m., said, "This is an oven-ready redevelopment opportunity available at a guide price of £675,000. Ramage's Bar in the Ayrshire town of Kilburnie is up for auction with a guide price of £120,000. Shepherd said, for anyone seeking a trading business, the long-established Ramage's Bar might be of interest. This opportunity includes a flat above, which could be leased or provide owners accommodation. The surveyor noted that, acting on behalf of Forestry and Land Scotland, the auction will also feature three areas of surplus land. These include two plots at Crean Larrach, both at guide prices of £5,000. The third area of surplus land, further north at Invergarry, is up for auction with a guide price of £35,000. The auction will also include former police stations at Lairg and Peterhead, being sold on behalf of Police Scotland. Shepherd said both buildings are suited to a variety of uses, subject to planning, with guide prices £145,000 and £65,000 respectively. All properties are open to remote bidding online, on the phone, and by proxy, Shepherd noted. The auction will also include a business centre in Bodham in Aberdeenshire, with potential for alternative use subject to planning at a guide price of £80,000. Steve Barnett, Managing Director at Shepherd Chartered Surveyors, said auctions offer the ability to sell all types of commercial property through our expansive network while providing transparency and simplicity of the process. Our offering goes further as we can offer local market advice from our in-house team of chartered surveyors throughout our national network of local offices. That article was by Ian McConnell. This is from the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 2nd of April 2024, from the business section. New pictures show how revamped Edinburgh Film House will look. This article is by Brian Donnelly. Filmgoers have been given a taste of how the new foyer for the refurbished Scottish cinema could look. Edinburgh Film House gave a first look at the plans after the cinema was awarded £1.5 million funding. The independent cinema opened in 1979 in a former Presbyterian church, but closed in 2022 following the collapse of umbrella company Centre for the Moving Image. A campaign to save it was backed by actors including Ewan Bremmer and Brian Cox. A business model was created to relaunch the cinema, with a board of trustees, including some who worked there for two decades, set up. The film house said the images are a first look at the proposed plan to open up the foyer and cafe space, adding, "We must stress that this is an initial concept drawing, not the finished design, and that that's not a new staff uniform." A crowdfunder aiming to raise £300,000 has so far reached £268,873. The trustees learned last month their application for money from the Levelling Up Fund was being granted by the UK government, and they are now preparing to sign the lease on May the 1st, ahead of a huge refurbishment. Plans include a complete refit, the addition of a fourth screen for educational use, and reducing the seating capacity from 450 to 350 to make it more comfortable, as well as increasing accessibility inside the cinema. That article was by Brian Donnelly. This is from the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 2nd of April 2024, from the business section. Student flats plan for former corn mill in Leith, Edinburgh. This article is by Brian Donnelly. Plans to create housing for more than 200 students at a historic city location have been brought forward. The proposals involve converting an historic former mill, which was later used as a cinema and is currently operating as a bingo hall. The developer, Longstone Limited, with Oberland as architect, said the proposed development at 24 Manderson Street will see the conversion of a former bingo hall into much-needed student housing. creating 201 high-quality student bed spaces with accompanying amenity spaces and facilities. This development aims to provide a catalyst for regeneration within the locality. It added, with the current occupier due to relocate to a new location in summer 2024, this application aims to ensure the smooth transition of the site and reduce risks associated with vacant properties that have the potential to blight local communities. Proposals seek to convert the existing building, preserving and enhancing key architectural features. The current operator of the Bingo Hall, Club 3000, plans to move to new premises in nearby Ocean Terminal this summer. Having been utilised for a range of activities over the years, including a mill, a cinema and bingo hall, the design aims to embrace the unique character of the building, providing bespoke and contemporary accommodation for students, the developer added. The site comprises a bingo hall, which formerly operated as a cinema, and incorporates elements of a 19th century corn mill and former railway viaduct, which provides access to the main structure. In the mid-1920s, the original corn mill building was gutted and heavily reconstructed and adapted to form the cinema. However, the overall form and footprint of the main volume of the building have survived from its origins as a mill. Upon the closure of the cinema in 1961, 24 Manderson Street was converted into a bingo hall. That article was by Brian Donnelly.
That concludes this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hume Review and tell your friends about our service.